just a quick unscientific poll here to lead off this morning as we mercifully are almost to November. How many of you have campaign fatigue? How many of you are tired of hearing about politics? Again, unscientific, but a lot of you. Okay, all the children, especially the children, you're tired of it. This is the time of year to DVR everything. All right. I am not going to talk about politics per se this morning. Okay, I appreciate the separation of church and state. One of the reasons I appreciate the separation of church and state is that I think the Church of Jesus Christ has a far, far greater hope than the state. And I would like the state to leave their hands off of that. Okay? And it's that hope, actually, that I want to talk to you about this morning. But before I get into that hope, and you can be turning to Psalm 46, which will be our text this morning, Psalm 46. Let's talk about why I want to talk about this. I've talked with many of you as friends, as neighbors, and we all kind of feel the same way as we look at this. You know, most of us are pretty tired of looking at this kind of ruthless, vindictive, conflict-oriented, dishonest politicking that's going on. We're kind of tired of the protests everywhere, of everything having to spill over into anger and violence and hatred toward our fellow brothers and sisters. I'm very concerned that we have either forgotten or we never really learned how to listen to each other, how to have a dialogue, how to have a conversation, how to understand someone, even if we strongly disagree with them. And even at the end of the day, you say, based on my biblical convictions, I still disagree with you, but I at least listened. I at least could repeat your view back to you in words that you agree with, that you think are fair. Honestly, like every time you turn on the news or just social media, even, and people are tired of social media, it feels like our whole country is like this, all these different classes and sects and groups and parties and individuals where we're pretty sure that we're right, like completely right, and that to the degree that you disagree with me, you're completely wrong, like you're moronically wrong. And we almost treat each other as less than human. It becomes a very dehumanizing thing. And I want to be very clear, this is not a Democrat or a Republican problem. It is not a liberal or a conservative problem, a rich or a poor, an urban or a rural, or an educated versus an uneducated problem. It's a human problem. And there's plenty of blame to go around. But none of that is the reason I'm talking about this morning, because frankly, I understand when people who have no hope act hopeless. I get that. But we have the hope of Christ. We have the hope of the gospel. So my concern is, why do Christians in many ways act exactly the same as the world, like hopeless? So here's what I see with Christians. On the one hand, we've got a group of Christians who are prepared to stand up and fight for absolutely every little opinion they have. You know, and they are mining the internet for the meme that puts it just perfectly in their not own words to say this other party, this other politician, this other person, this other group, look how dumb they are. And we use those terms and we say people are stupid, showing them complete disrespect as Christians. Then I see another group of Christians that's just like, you know what, I'm done. This is so messed up all across the board. And I hear more of this election than I've ever heard before. Christians just looking at the options and saying, I don't have an option as a Christian. I'm done. I'm withdrawing, in a sense, from politics, from culture. Like, what's the point of even trying? And this morning, I want to suggest a third way forward. That you don't have to be one of these people trolling the internet, looking for ways to attack the other and prove that they're wrong and dumb and have no heart at all. And you also don't have to just withdraw and just resign to, well, this terrible stuff is happening. The third way forward is Psalm 46. So let's look at that. Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She will not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still. Be still. And know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. This is the word of the Lord. I love the practicality of this psalm. Here's the 4 points that I find in this psalm, okay? It's this easy. You live in a troubled world. You have a great big sovereign God. Your citizenship is elsewhere. Now live like it. Let's just take each of those for a few minutes. You live in a troubled world, number one. And Richard said this in introducing Martin Luther's A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. But we have a tendency to think, oh, man, like all this stuff is just kind of spiraling out of control. And you realize that every generation before has felt that pretty much. Like this is the generation that the Bible talked about. Things are getting worse and worse. And we don't realize often that, in fact, culture in many ways is a sine wave, and it goes down and it goes back up in some ways, and it goes down and it goes back up in some ways. But we live in a troubled world, and the Bible says that over and over again. And we as believers should look back to the Garden of Eden and say, I understand why we live in a troubled world, because everything broke. Everything fell because of sin, and it infected everything. Of course, we have struggles. You know, the first thing I see the psalmist saying here about this troubled world, he's literally saying, along with natural disasters, there are a lot of man-made disasters. Okay, and you hear his language here where he's talking about the earth giving way and the mountains falling into the sea and trembling and swelling and the oceans roaring and foaming. And we look to the news and we see, you know, F5 tornadoes and earthquakes. And is it fracking fluid that's causing more earthquakes? I mean, I don't know, but the earth seems to tremble a lot these days, you know. And what's going to happen when California falls off into the Pacific Ocean? And Marty and I were in San Francisco a couple weeks ago, and I was like, why are we so high in our hotel? I mean, this is just going to make it that much harder to get out when San Andreas, you know, the movie, like when that all plays out. And then I literally thought this. I'm looking at our hotel window and there's AT&T Park where the Giants play. And I thought, at least I know where to go when this all goes down, because The Rock will parachute in. I'll meet up with him. You know, he has to survive. So I'm just going to stick with him. But my point is, we look to our earth and the shakings and the swellings and the foamings of hurricanes and all this stuff that goes on. And we think, oh, no. And that's OK. That's a natural reaction to these things. But the writer here is saying, you know, this was 3000 years ago almost that the writer's writing these psalms. And he's like, yeah, it's going on here, too. And then you notice in verse 6, he switches the attention from natural disasters to man-made disasters. He says this, he says, the nations rage, the kingdoms totter. And you take those words, rage and totter, I mean, those are giving us ideas of anger and violent conflict and disintegration. And what he said, like the word rage is literally the roaring, and it could be the roaring of politicians who just talk and talk and talk. And you're like, enough already. The totter, things falling, economically collapsing, whether it's a city or an empire, things that once were big and strong have just completely dissolved. Whole kingdoms and nations dissolved. If you want to turn back to Psalm 2 for a moment, because one of the things I'm hearing from Christians a lot, again, this election cycle that I don't remember hearing as much ever before, is, and this is my liberal friends, this is my conservative friends saying, I don't see a party anymore. I don't see a person that really espouses much of a biblical worldview at all. One party has grown so incredibly secularized, it doesn't stand up for my view of the awe, the holiness, the unapproachability, the worthiness of God. And the lack of compassion, like utter lack of compassion in another part. They're like, how do I deal with that as a believer? This isn't something new. Look at Psalm 2, verse 1. We read, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? the kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. So I take these words to mean God himself, God's work, and God's people will always be opposed. Always. All throughout history, people and nations have opposed. The idea of throwing off the bonds is like these are certain constraints that God has put on humanity for our good, for our benefit, so that we can love and care for each other. And we say, I'm not going to live under those constraints. I'm going to be free of those things. And today we see that acted out in real time. We say today, let's do the opposite of protecting innocent life. Let's do the opposite of that. Let's do the opposite of honoring God's design for gender and sexuality. Let's do the opposite of that. Let's do the opposite of welcoming the immigrant. Let's do the opposite of encouraging personal responsibility. Let's do the opposite of preserving the rights of the family. Let's do the opposite of loving our enemies. Let's do the opposite of respecting the rule of law. Let's do the opposite of protecting the freedom to worship. But none of these things are new. And some of you, especially older ones, you know, maybe you've seen things, what you would deem better in our country or our culture, but you need to knock it off with the, you know, with the scaring the younger generations as if something's going on now that's never happened before. Just read your Bible. It's happened before. Psalm 2. Or, you know, go forward 1,000 years. This is what the Apostle Paul told his younger friend, Timothy, in the faith. He's mentoring him. He's discipling him. He lives in a very pagan place, a very messed up place politically and culturally. And this is what he tells him. 2 Timothy 3, he says, understand this, Timothy. In the last days, there will come times of difficulty. For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Sound like today? Well, it does, but it sounds like human history too. So there's point one, okay? You live in a troubled world. You encouraged? You know, part of what's encouraging to me about this is even before you get to God, which God changes everything, but even before you get to God, it's like if you went to Rome and you saw the Colosseum standing there and you were standing there looking at the Colosseum, and as you were standing there looking at it, like some rocks crumbled and fell. I mean, you could think, oh no, the Colosseum is falling apart. And then you could have the realization of like, this big, huge thing has been here for a really, really long time. And yes, it is falling apart, but at this rate, it's going to take a little bit longer. And that in and of itself would be encouraging. This is something that the Reformers called the common grace of God. That as bad as things are, there are evidences of common grace, common kindness, common love. Because God has stamped his image on everyone. Even people who reject him are capable of doing good and preserving certain pieces that God once preserved over time. But this whole point about you live in a troubled world leads us really to the point of Psalm 46. And that is, yes, you live in a troubled world, but you have a great and sovereign God. And I want every single one of you to ground your heart, ground your soul, ground your emotions in this truth. God was here and he was sovereign long before the mess was here. And he'll be here and he'll be sovereign long after the mess is gone. Now look at Psalm 46. If you just skim it, verse 1, he is our refuge and strength. Verse 4, he's the Most High. Verse 7, verse 10, he's the Lord of hosts, which is literally the Lord of armies. Again, verses 7 and verse 10, he says, he's the God of Jacob. Verse 7, he is our fortress and our stronghold. Verse 10, he is the one God who will be exalted in all the earth. Those are great reminders when you're prone to anxiety or anger or fear. That first of all, the psalmist is saying, God reigns, period, with nothing above him, nothing beside him. That's what this name Most High means, the name El Elyon. Means Most High, means there's nothing above him. any superlative that you could think of. God is the highest. God is the best. God is the greatest. God is the strongest. God is the wisest. Any superlative you could think of, that's God. That's what this word means. Going on, verse 10, he simply says, I am God. And notice he doesn't say, I am a God. I'm one God among many. He says, I'm God, period. I'm the God. I will be exalted. I win. Listen to what he says in Isaiah 44, verse 6. Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts. Again, the Lord of armies. I am the first. I am the last. Beside me, there is no God. No God. Two chapters later, he says, to whom will you liken me and compare me? Who will you make my equal that we may be alike? For I am God and there is no other. I am God and there's none like me. God reigns with none above or beside him. But you know what else he's saying here is that God ultimately controls every facet of human history. And I could stand here this morning and I don't have the perfect answer for, well, if God is so much in control of every facet of human history, then why do so many bad things happen? And that's probably the biggest question that non-believers or even the atheist would ask. Like, if your God, the God of the Bible, exists, then why all the bad stuff? That doesn't look like he's in control. And I don't have a perfect answer to that. I know in part, this bad stuff happens because we've done the opposite of what that God told us to do. So that is the outcome of rejecting God's way and rejecting God himself. But look at verses 8 and 9, because what the psalmist, because he doesn't even go into that question. Like, okay, David or whoever, Asaph, whoever wrote this particular psalm, how do you explain the evil in the world? If all he says is, yes, there's evil, but all of those evil things, all of those violent things, they have their limit. Wars happen. Violence happens. But they can only go so far. And God restrains in his grace. And he says, come, behold the works of the Lord. He's inviting us, come and study what God has done to shape history so that we're all still here. And even more importantly, so that his master plan of redemption is still going forward in spite of all the bad stuff. Let me show you one detail here that makes this point, okay? Verse 7 and verse 10, I mentioned in passing, okay, we get stuff. When God says, like, I am a fortress, I am a refuge, we're like, okay, yeah, yeah. And then he's like, and I'm the God of Jacob. And we're like, what? You know, you guys know who Jacob was in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis? He's the conniving, manipulative, deceitful younger brother of Esau who... he tricks his brother to get his birthright. Then he goes and lies to his blind father to get the blessing. He's a bad dude. He's a lowlife. That's who Jacob was. And there comes a night in his life where he's running from his brother Esau because he thinks Esau is coming to kill me and get back what is rightfully his. And he is alone and he's scared and he cries out to God. And God shows up. And this is a weird story. God shows up. He wrestles with God. He walks with a limp the rest of his life, the Bible says. God breaks him on that night. God breaks him of the manipulative, deceitful Jacob. He breaks him. But God also gives him a new name. And do you know what the new name is? Israel. And Jacob becomes the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. And what's beautiful about that is if God's purpose and plan is all about rescuing and transforming sinners and making them something they're not, he's not afraid to say, I'm a God of a guy like Jacob. You can put him on me. Because his sin and his stupidity was no match for my grace. And God's saying, I can take a guy like that and I can move my plan forward. 12 tribes, a new people of God, who are supposed to go now and bring my blessing to the ends of the earth. That's pretty cool. It's pretty cool that we could say the God of Jacob is our God, because we do sinful, stupid stuff too. It's not just the people out there who are doing these kinds of things. It's us. And God is ultimately controlling not just the course of someone else's history, but the course of our personal history. And then finally, as I say that God is sovereign, I don't want you to picture him as this king who sits way far away on the throne. And you're like, yes, we worship you. But like, how is that practical for us that you're so great? You have that picture in Scripture, but what is the picture here? The picture here is that God is sovereign and invites you to take refuge in Him. And you've got all these words here. Verse 1, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help. Very present, that's kind of redundant. Like, aren't you either present or you're not? Like, how are you very present? It could even better be translated, He's completely sufficient. Very is the word almost like completely or extravagantly, abundantly. And the word that is represented here as present is actually more like the word enough. He's very enough. Whatever you're going through, He's like, I invite you to see that I'm very enough for anything that you're facing. Verse 5, He says, God will help her when morning dawns. Verses 7 and 10, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. And you have all these different images, and actually three different words are used here for one idea, and it's the idea of a safe house. These uber wealthy, you know, celebrities and movie stars and musicians and all that, as they build their ginormous houses, you know, in Beverly Hills and all that, more and more of them are building a house underneath their house. I don't know if you know that. But they're basically like hollowing out this huge space in the rock under their house, and it's a safe house. And you're talking about like really thick steel and reinforced concrete. And the idea is that whether it's an F5 tornado or ISIS or the random intruder who wants their baseball card collection or literally nuclear war, they're going to go down there with 49 of their closest friends and be fine. This is the word that God uses here to represent Himself. He's essentially saying, let me be your safe house. So when that thing happens in your culture, in your life, your first instinct is not to retreat to some other coping mechanism or some other person or thing or your money or your reputation or anything like that. Your first instinct is to retreat into Me and realize you're safe in Me. So the sovereign God, the picture is He's not just strong for Himself. You know, a bunker, there's no point in a bunker just being a strong, empty place. The bunker is strong for someone. And God is strong for you. God is strong for His people. God is saying, I invite you to believe that I win. And that you are safe in Me. Because I'm a great big sovereign God. Nothing and no one jeopardizes anything I've ever intended for anyone. And we could end there because that's awesome. Everybody should walk out of here and be like, okay, I'm fine. Whatever happens next week and from now on in my life, if I believe that, I'm fine. But He goes on further, and speaking of a safe house, He goes really into that because now He says, not only do you have a great sovereign God in the midst of this trouble, but in fact, your citizenship is elsewhere. Look at verses 4 and 5 again. He says, there's a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. Do you believe that? Augustine believed it. He wrote a book, City of God. You know, and the Roman Empire had collapsed and all the Christians are wringing their hands. Oh, no, what do we do? And Augustine, and I'm seriously abbreviating what City of God is about, but he basically says there's a city of man, there's a city of God. The city of man can rise and fall and rise and fall and rise and fall and rise and fall. The city of God cannot be moved. And your citizenship is there. Stop worrying. That's my first point here that the psalmist makes. He's saying there's both a place that's untouchable and an inheritance that is secure. And I think we often wring our hands and wring our hearts over the troubles of this world because it is attacking what is most important to us and we freak out. And that's a reality. If you're tripping out over the things that are happening in your life or our culture, it's because you put way too much treasure in what can be attacked, in what can be diminished, which is why Jesus said, you know, and we're coming to this in the Sermon on the Plain or the Sermon on the Mount, don't lay up treasure here, right, where moths can eat it and rust can corrode it and thieves can break in and steal it. Lay up treasure somewhere. It's this point that somewhere that it's untouchable. So what if we heard God saying to us, there's a city that will not be moved. And if you believe in My Son, Jesus, your citizenship is already there. You have a guaranteed place that's being held for you. And what if you were laying up all your treasure there while just living this life here? Okay, that's one way of looking at it. But let's say the flip side as well. Not only is there a place that's untouchable, what does that mean about here and now? Well, it means that we're just sojourners. The Bible uses several different words. We're just resident aliens. We're just strangers and pilgrims passing through. Jesus himself said, "My kingdom is not of this world." You know, when the disciples are sitting there and they're freaking out because Jesus has been arrested, and they're like, "Oh, no, Jesus, fight back. You know, take a sword, do something, Jesus." And he's standing there before Pilate and he says, "The reason I'm not fighting is not because I don't think I couldn't lick you. I could whoop you. The reason I'm not fighting is because my kingdom is not of this world. I came to lay down my life and take it up again and invite you to come with me to a place that's safe and untouchable." So we're just sojourners here. Philippians 3:20, Paul says, our citizenship is in heaven. This is the same Paul who several times he stood firmly on his rights as a Roman citizen. And he said, "You can't do this to me. I get a proper trial." Why? Because I'm a Roman citizen. So understand, it's like a dual citizenship. I'm not saying that you stop being patriotic, you just give up on America, you don't care. I mean, we have a constitution, we have rights. It's okay to say as a Christian, "Hey, you are trampling my rights. I'm going to assert those rights now." I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying if our ultimate citizenship is in heaven, then we got to be willing to be treated unjustly, which is exactly what happens to Paul. I mean, the Roman Empire just looks the other way, trounces his Roman citizenship rights, and ends up imprisoning him for years and then martyring him for nothing except preaching the gospel. We've got to be willing to have that happen to him. But you know what? He's like, basically, "I don't care. If I go there now, that's fine, because that has been my ultimate dream ever since I met Jesus on the road to Damascus, was to know that my citizenship was there and I'm just passing through here." 1 Peter 2:11 says the same thing. We're sojourners, we're exiles. And I think if Peter were here today, he would say, "Christian, remember, you are not first Democrats and Republicans. You're not even first Americans. You are first followers of Jesus Christ. You're redeemed people of God. Your citizenship is in the city of God. Now, point four, live like it." And one of the reasons I love Psalm 46 is there's no pie in the sky theology here. We're not sitting there like, "Oh, man, what does the psalmist mean? I have no idea." No, he says, okay, you live in a troubled world. You have a great big sovereign God. Your citizenship is elsewhere. Therefore, relax. That's Psalm 46. I'm being serious. Look at verse 10. The psalmist says 1, 2, and 3 are true. They've been true in every generation. "Therefore, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth." Do you know what it means to be still? Any of your parents ever have a child with night terrors? I'm not talking about a nightmare. A nightmare is when they wake up because they just had a bad dream that the milk and the fruit snacks are gone. A nightmare is when, you know, the bad puppies on Paw Patrol have attacked them and assailed them and they don't know how to defend their crib. That's a nightmare. A night terror is blood-curdling screams and a tense, rigid body and eyes that are fluttering and agitations like thrashing and kicking and trying to throw punches. And the crazy thing is, with a night terror, they're not awake. And as a parent, what can you do if your child is having a night terror? Can't wake them up. You can't reason with them and say, "Look, you're only seeing a part of reality, or the reality that you think is reality is actually not reality. You need to see a bigger thing." You can't do that. You know what you do with your child when they're having a night terror? You hold them so they don't hurt themselves, and you wait. And maybe you wait 5 minutes. Maybe you wait 10 minutes. Maybe you wait 30 minutes. But there comes a moment, boom, it's like they snap and the whole body just goes limp and it's over. "Be still" is literally a Hebrew word that means go limp. Go limp. Relax. Okay, you're having a great big night terror and you can say, "But it's true, but it's real. This is going on in politics and culture and the Christian right and the Christian, I mean, just, oh, And God says, do you believe that you are held? Do you believe that I have you? And you can kick and scream and you can reason with God and you can yell and be like, what about this? What about this? And some of you, honestly, this morning just need to go limp with God and relax. And that's so practical. Okay, we're talking about living like 1, 2, and 3 are true. We're talking about living as if, yes, the world is a troubled place, but God is sovereign and our citizenship is there, not here. Let me just give you a couple practical applications of this in closing, okay? Being still and knowing that God is God and will be exalted means we sit here this morning and we say together, we choose faith over fear. We choose faith. And we just say, I'm going to base my hope on what I believe to be true about God and his plan for my life and our world. And by the way, the election season is a great opportunity. It forces you to stop and say, what am I really putting my hope in? Because you know what we do even as Christians? We put our hope, we're like, God, I pray that this person gets elected and this thing happens and this stops happening and da-da-da. And if you do that, and what are we doing? We're putting our faith not in God. We are putting our faith in a desired set of outcomes from God. And God says, stop it. Stop putting your faith in a set of desired outcomes and trust me. You know, in the best of times, your hope should never be in a politician or a party or a public policy. Never. Not in the best of times. The only thing that's ever worthy of our hope is King Jesus. He's the Lord of armies. And you know what? I read the last chapter and he wins. He wins. I've read the end of the story, and so have many of you. So trust in God's character. Trust in God's plan to rescue fallen humanity. You know, God's plan for the world was not to hold back every culture everywhere and every city everywhere from sin. He let sin happen so that people wreck their lives, so that they're like, man, I wrecked my life. How do I get out of this? And he says, here's how you get out of it. I came and I took your sin. And I died on a cross and I rose again and I can cleanse you and I can forgive you. And that's what God's up to, is saving people through Jesus. You know, our culture is shifting. It is. I've read propositions and bills that have actually been signed into law in the past year. I've read the actual wording of them. You cannot deny that our culture is shifting further from a biblical understanding of virtually everything. But guess what that means? If the environment in which the church operates and lives is getting darker, guess what that means? Well, it means what we read earlier, right? Philippians 2:14. I mean, look at it here. Renewal. He says, basically, Christians, stop grumbling and disputing. Okay, stop complaining. Stop fighting and arguing with other people who disagree with you. That's what he's saying. It's so practical. That you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. Okay, it's a crooked, twisted generation. I get that. Among whom you shine as lights in the world. Okay, if it gets darker and Christians stay true to Christ and their affection for Christ and their allegiance to Christ, we have a greater opportunity than before. If that's why God left us here to sojourn, to be pilgrims, to be walking through life on this planet still, it's like, pull people out of there and love them and give them hope in my name. And it's getting darker. Fine. Don't curse the darkness. Light a candle. Or God already did in you. Now go be it. Back to Peter. 1 Peter 2 puts it like this. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that even while they speak against you as evildoers, they see your good deeds. And they glorify God in the day of visitation. Now that's interesting because it's saying, like, even while they're slandering you, they see you being Christ-like. And how would they glorify God in the day of visitation? I think what he means is that many of them are won to Christ by your testimony, by your light shining in the worst of times. So let me close with this. If the world is filled with trouble, but God is sovereign and your inheritance is secure, then how do we as Christians actually live like that, whether we lean conservative or liberal? Because it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. I mean, Christians, wherever you land, I mean, we're called to the same things. And I just want to use Micah 6:8 as a very simple framework in closing. Many of you know it, where he says, there's a lot of things you could do and not do. He has shown you what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? And let me just take a moment with each of those. If we are going to live as if God is sovereign and our citizenship is elsewhere, that means not only choosing faith over fear, but secondly, it means choosing social justice over self-advantage. And I want you to note in Micah 6:8, God says, do justice. I'm a fan of having conversations and conferences about social justice. But at some point, you got to walk out of the conference and do justice, because you can talk and talk and talk. And some of you know this. You can talk and talk and talk about all kinds of things and never solve anybody's problem. This is what the Church of Jesus should be famous for, is just actions on behalf of other people. Okay? And by the way, justice has a meaning, and we bring all kinds of meanings to words now. But in the Bible, justice is the idea of treating people according to God's standards of right and wrong. And that means punishing guilty people, and that means rewarding good people or protecting the innocent. You guys know the famous Lady Justice statue. It's often carved in stones, and very often she's holding a scale in one hand and a sword in the other. But there's something else peculiar about Lady Justice most of the time, and that is she's blindfolded. You know why Lady Justice is blindfolded? Because the idea is, I don't look at who's in the dock. It doesn't matter who's on trial, because true justice is objective. It's impartial. So if we look at our country and we see that the powerful and the influential and certain classes and certain tribes and parties of people are above the law or outside the law, while the powerless, the nobodies, they get treated by a different standard. That's something that we as believers should be at the forefront of saying, I am going to seek and do justice for those people who don't get justice. Okay, and we can do that together collectively in culture. We can also do that on a personal level. And what I mean by that is, you ever notice how often, I mean, we all think our motives are completely as pure as the wind-driven snow, right? They're not. Okay, stop and think about this. When I'm talking about social justice versus self-interest, when you think about, like, okay, how am I going to vote? Who am I going to vote for? Et cetera, how often do you sit there and just think, what's best for me? You know, who's going to lower my tax bracket? Who's going to make my insurance better? Who's going to do this and this and this and this and this for me and for my kids where we're at? And the Christian way instead is not to say, wait, what's best for me in a vacuum? It is to say, what's right? What's just? That's where I'm going. Okay, that's justice. Now, next, let's choose loving kindness over lectures. The next phrase in Micah 6:8 simply says, love mercy. And the first word, love, means love, have an affection for. The second word is tricky. It's the Hebrew word hesed. It's my favorite Hebrew word. But it has a huge semantic range. It can mean mercy, as translated here, but it can also mean loyalty or kindness or steadfast love. And that's why I use this word loving kindness, the old King James word, because I think that captures the most of it. And this is one of the things that strikes me when every time I go back to Micah 6:8, I'm like, oh, right. God never told believers to love dogmatically being right about everything. It's where some of us camp out. But he says, love, love. And just think about that for a second. How many people have you ever won over to your position because you insulted them? And you said, your position is so dumb. I can't even have this conversation. You're such a this. And they were like, wow, I see that now. You are so right. All the time. Like, you're always right. I should just follow you. I should just do whatever you're doing because you're always right. Nobody ever gets convinced that way. By the same token, I mean, you give pandering lectures to people, they don't get won over. We follow a Jesus who says, I am the truth. So Christians should be extraordinarily concerned about truth, but not at the expense of loving someone who doesn't get the truth. Or more often than not, just someone who doesn't agree with our opinion. What impact do you think Christians could make on the world if we were characterized by love, we listened, we empathized with those, and this person says, you know, I know you disagree with my position, I know you disagree with my lifestyle, but I've never been so loved. You know, I see this in my wife. My wife has people in her life that they could literally say that to her. I know that on the authority of Scripture, you disagree with this in my life, but you love me, and I've never questioned that. You know, some of you here, you're Patriots fans, you're Seahawks fans. That's a problem. I mean, that's a big problem. But what I see in this text is that no matter how far apart we are, you're still a human made in God's image, and we're called to love you and show mercy to you, but not on the football field. You get the point. We can lecture, we can insult, we can do all these things that we see happening in our culture, or we can stop and have conversations and listen. And maybe even ask someone that we disagree with, what would it look like for me to love you? What would it take for you to feel or to be convinced of my love for you? And then listen. Do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with God. In other words, choose humility over hypocrisy. There's no such thing as a humble hypocrite. Hypocrisy is born out of pride. And there's nothing I see more in our culture today than the utter inability for people and parties to look at ourselves first. Do you realize the people you hate, and I'll just use that word, hopefully you don't hate people, but you know what, like the people that you're like, they are so wrong, they're probably not as bad as you think they are. And the people that you support and are like, this person got it, they're probably not as good as you think they are. And if you applied the same standards to both, and I see this over and over again, people just wrangling about, this candidate is so anti this. And I'm like, well, what do you think about, who are you voting for? Well, I'm voting for this person instead. Well, you see this, right? Like, the thing that you're so upset about, like, your person does the same thing, right? You see that. No, I don't see that. See, our inability to see that is, where's that coming from? It's coming from a place of pride. And I think, you know, instead of hating this person or this group or that and just constantly fighting, what if our tendency was to look at our own selves first and say, this really bothers me when I see it in this person. I wonder how I do the same thing myself. Let's hold our views with civility and integrity as much as we possibly can. I come back to this quote by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. Wouldn't that be great? There's the bad people. They're gone. Now culture is so wonderful with us. He says it doesn't work that way because the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And what if that was your starting point? And this is biblical, by the way. Paul looks at himself and he's like, I'm the chief of sinners. The things I want to do, I don't do those things. I do things I don't want to do. Oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me, a saved man, from this body of death? You know, and Martin Luther, we sang his hymn this morning, but he was famous for saying simultaneously saint and sinner. I am both at the same time. I'm not all saint and I'm not all sinner. Some of you think I'm worse than I am. Some of you think I'm better than I am. The line dividing good and evil cuts through our hearts. What if we saw that first? And what if we realized that the only hope I have is the unconditional free grace of Jesus Christ? And I'm going to bring that hope to my culture, to my neighborhood and my neighbors. Humbly. Relax. God wins. And he does. So again, this is where I want to land this whole thing. We have an unprecedented opportunity, friends, to be a community of some leaning more conservative, some leaning more liberal, some being rich, some being poor, some being black, some being white. We have an opportunity to be a community that embraces these four things: faith, justice, mercy, humility, and just say, we're not going to get down in the weeds and argue and fight and lose our heads in anger and anxiety and argumentation and all these things. We're going to go forward together, civil and compassionate, doing good for our neighbor, no matter how much we disagree with him. Dietrich Bonhoeffer once said, and I close with this, he said, if you board the wrong train, it's no use running along the corridor in the other direction. If your ultimate allegiance, if you're like, I'm getting on the, you know, the Hillary train, the Trump train, the I'm third party, I'm above the fray. You know, some of us feel that way. I'm an independent, and I actually am. But if you board that train and you're like, this is the hope, I'm getting on this, and you're going this way, and you're like, but I want, and you realize you're getting further and further from biblical Christianity by following a person and a party and a policy, and you start running in the opposite direction, you're doing this number. You're like, whoops, I'm getting further and further away. And that's what Dietrich Bonhoeffer was saying. You got to get on the right train. The right train is Jesus. The right train is a God who sits in the heavens and does whatever he wants. And we have, again, we have an amazing opportunity to say, he gets the fundamental allegiance of my heart. I find my identity and my security in him. Board the right train. Get on with God. Relax. He wins.